listened to the story of Mrs. Kennedy's outing. At first in Constitution Avenue, they had been recognized by this time by perhaps 20 people. They fell in behind the police and the few reporters. And the Attorney General and Mrs. Kennedy then turned and walked south on First Street. They met a large group of nuns. Mrs. Kennedy stopped for a moment to accept their condolences, and she thanked them. They walked on farther south on First Street. And at this point, the Attorney General said something to Mrs. Kennedy. She nodded in agreement. The traffic is extremely heavy on the streets in this area, and the Secret Service man called police. Traffic was stopped, and the Attorney General and Mrs. Kennedy then weaved their way through the stopped traffic to the limousine that had followed them down Capitol Hill, and they got into the limousine and went back to the White House. This moment of privacy, alone in a great throng of people, while Mrs. Kennedy, had lasted perhaps 16 minutes. The amazing thing about it was that so few people recognized her, and secondly, that she made this walk and visited this area with such a small amount of protection. The respect of the people who did recognize her was enormous. They kept their distance and permitted Mrs. Kennedy, the widow of the president, and the president's brother, the Attorney General, to be alone in the midst of this great crowd. Later in the evening, perhaps an hour after Mrs. Kennedy had visited here, four ladies of the Kennedy family also came to the rotunda to pay their respects. Mrs. Rose Kennedy, the mother of the president, Mrs. Eunice, Ethel, and Joan Kennedy. Miss Joan Kennedy is the wife of the senator. Ethel is the wife of the Attorney General. Eunice is the wife of Sergeant Shriver, the director of the Peace Corps. The four of them came. They went inside the small enclosure where the catafalque and the body of the president lies, and kneeled, and for just a moment, recited a silent prayer, and then they too left. A moment ago, the president's brother-in-law, Stephen Smith, appeared here to pay his respects. Apparently, throughout the evening, there will be other visitations by members of the Kennedy family and by close friends and by relatives, members of the family. This is Bryson Rash reporting from the Rotunda.
A reporter well acquainted with the new president, Lyndon B. Johnson, the successor of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, is NBC's Robert Abernathy, and here is his story.
I was talking one night with Lyndon Johnson's longtime assistant, George Reedy. It was just after the man who is now president had surprised many of his friends and agreed to John Kennedy's request that he run for vice president. What kind of man is this, I wanted to know. I had watched him as majority leader of the Senate, standing with his hands in his pockets by his front row desk, speaking so quietly we in the gallery could hardly hear him. I'd known his reputation as a persuasive Senate operator, a man who knew his colleagues instinctively, knew how to reward them or threaten them or plead with them to get something done. I'd known his reputation as a rather flamboyant Texan. But what kind of man was he, really? George Reedy, I knew, was one of those many persons who've worked for Mr. Johnson for years, endured much, long hours, sudden changes of plan, and yet developed fierce loyalty to their boss. George Reedy, I knew, was by no means an objective source, but he had something important to say. I believe it more today than I did then. I've learned to agree with him. The senator, said George Reedy, speaking of the man who is now president, is like a combat general. There's much truth in this. Don't think of a chief of staff or a Pentagon planner. Think of a battlefield commander, perhaps a George Patton. Lyndon Johnson is tough. He admires power and its decisive use. As a congressman on the Naval Affairs Committee, as a senator on the Armed Services Committee, its Preparedness Subcommittee, and on the Space Committee, he has been concerned with national security. He is proud of the process of our government, and as majority leader of the Senate, he often seemed more interested in getting action than he did in the precise nature of the action. He can be expected to command and to lead. The questions then are, can he lead and in what direction? Taking the second question first, the question of direction, those who know Lyndon Johnson best doubt that there will be any major change in foreign or domestic policy. When he was a senator from Texas, Lyndon Johnson got a conservative reputation. He was representing his generally conservative state. But when he was a congressman in the 30s, it should be recalled that he ran for office as a 100% Franklin Roosevelt New Dealer. And since he was elected vice president, he's been down the line with John Kennedy policies, active particularly not only in space development, but also in equal employment opportunities. Lyndon Johnson's directions can be expected to be the same as John Kennedy's. And can he lead? Certainly in those processes with government which require personal contact and persuasion, President Johnson will be effective. Effective, by the way, is one of his favorite words. He wants to make things happen. The skills he developed as majority leader of the Senate will serve him and the country well. As an executive, however, as the master of a complex machine, he may be less experienced. He operates personally. He's always had a small staff. He may find it difficult to be the chief organization man in the country's largest organization. He can be expected to become angry at bureaucracy. But the presidency is more than personal contact among men, more than executive processes. It is perhaps above all things a position requiring the ability to touch the hearts of a majority of us. I've watched and listened to Lyndon Johnson on the campaign trail, standing before a strange audience in a strange city, reaching out for them with words and stories, trying to find what will move their hearts. When he speaks ad lib, when he's with a sympathetic crowd, Lyndon Johnson can be, as he wants to be, most effective. He draws out country stories and, believe it or not, can be very funny. But a president cannot so often speak ad lib. A president must read out loud. John Kennedy was a master at this. His style was literate, polished, thoroughly educated. He was effective on television. Lyndon Johnson will not do this nearly as well. He has other gifts, many of them, but this, reading a speech, is not one of them. We will all have to adjust to this and to the difference between the accents of Boston and the West Texas Hills, between the products of Harvard and Southwest State Teachers College. But once we do make the adjustment, we may find that underneath that unfamiliar twang and manner, there is a man of great strength, of great physical strength, but also of the strength of purpose which commands support. His greatest immediate problem will be to communicate this, and ours to let it be communicated. This is Robert Abernethy, NBC News, Washington.
Another of NBC's reporters well acquainted with the new first family is Nancy Dickerson.
It's always said that in America, a man can be born in a cabin and rise to the presidency. That's exactly what Lyndon Baines Johnson has done. He's truly a modern Horatio Alger. Few men have started with less. His parents could give him little more than encouragement and spiritual values. Mr. Johnson is very proud of his humble start. The little wooden frame house where he was born is smaller than the living room of many American homes, but it is the first thing he shows to all the famous guests who visit at the LBJ Ranch in Stonewall, Texas. Often, after long hours of campaigning, President Johnson likes to reminisce. He talks about those early days when he was a shoeshine boy in Johnson City. Mrs. Johnson has always campaigned with her husband. She used to be somewhat shy, but now she's very articulate on the campaign stump or whenever she gives speeches anywhere. She does know politics as well as any woman. The Johnsons love to go to their ranch in Texas. It's there that they get into their ranch clothes, they ride, they relax, they entertain their old friends, and they spend time with their two daughters, Linda Bird and Lucy Baines, both are teenagers. President Johnson loves to tease his two daughters, and they are very proud of him. They're also very unaffected, even though most of their lives have been spent in the limelight. Lucy Baines has lots of boyfriends. Linda is engaged. She may be married next summer. We might even see a White House wedding sometime next year. Mrs. Johnson is a remarkable woman. She never seems to lose her composure, even under extraordinary circumstances. I well remember the day in Austin, Texas, when 14 of us reporters, reporting on the campaign, landed at the airport there. The hotels were all filled. It was convention time. So Mr. Johnson invited us all to the ranch for the weekend. He called ahead to say that we'd all be there. But such surprises as that never seem to faze Mrs. Johnson. She just takes them in her stride. Her nickname, Ladybird, was given to her shortly after she was born. A nurse looked at her and said, "Why, she looks just like a little ladybird." And the nickname has always stuck. Her real name is Claudia, but even in the congressional directory, she's listed as Mrs. Ladybird Johnson. Her best friends call her Bird. The Johnsons used to have a medium-sized house in Washington. Since he was elected to the vice presidency, they moved to a bigger place, a 9-bedroom mansion. They installed a heated swimming pool. It's a therapeutic measure. Heated swimming was suggested for Mr. Johnson by his doctors after his heart attack some years ago. Despite that heart attack, the president keeps such a fast and long pace that his aides have a tough time keeping up with him. And that goes for those who report on his activities, too. President Johnson loves to have people around him. He loves to talk with them about politics in peace. Since he was elected to the vice president, see, the Johnsons have entertained extensively, both their old friends as well as government officials. One of their most notable characteristics is their naturalness, their ability to be in the limelight, but to be unaffected by it. This is Nancy Dickerson of NBC News at the Capitol.
Despite his periodic trips abroad, much of the world feels it does not yet know Lyndon B. Johnson. President Kennedy had proved himself during times of crisis. A firm stand on the Russian missiles in Cuba. A quick response to repeated Soviet harassment along the Berlin Autobahn. These had given our allies around the world an awareness that the U.S. and its policies abroad do not fold up under communist pressure. But this feeling had developed before the tragic assassination. And now the question, what of the future? Will the Johnson administration be a continuation of Kennedy foreign policies? What of the Atlantic Alliance and of the war in Southeast Asia? An appraisal of the dramatic events of the past few days and what they mean to the future as seen in major capitals around the world. First, to the NBC post nearest the Iron Curtain, John Chancellor in Berlin.
The main question being asked here in Berlin tonight is, will the death of President Kennedy make a difference in the status of West Berlin? And the answer, from qualified observers, is no. That does not mean, however, that there will be no trouble in the coming weeks or months in Berlin or on the Autobahn which links it with the West or in its air corridors. The position of Berlin as a jousting ground for both sides in the Cold War was not altered or changed during the years of the Kennedy administration, and it is not likely to change during the tenure of the Johnson administration. The West will not pull out of Berlin short of war, and the Soviet Union will not start a war to force the West out. That was true under Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy, and it will be true under President Johnson. However, Berlin is an exposed, surrounded outpost tied to the West by slender and vulnerable threads in the air and on the ground. Since 1945, the Soviet Union has been whittling away the Western rights of access to Berlin, and that was going on earlier this month when the Russians held up an American convoy on the Autobahn. The dispute on the Autobahn is an ancient one by Cold War standards, and it remains unresolved. It appears likely that there will be other confrontations on the Autobahn, perhaps more erosion of Western rights on the road. But the Western commitment to West Berlin itself is too fundamental to the balance of politics in Central Europe to be changed by the death of one man, no matter how important he was, no matter how much he is mourned. But Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union are another matter. It is true tonight that the presses and transmitters of East European and Soviet propagandists are preparing an indictment of invective about the handling of the Lee Harvey Oswald case, and that the murder of President Kennedy will be depicted behind the Iron Curtain as the work of the extreme right in the United States. That is annoying, but perhaps not fundamental. What is fundamental is that the leader of the European communists, Nikita Khrushchev of the Soviet Union, had a working relationship with the leader of the West, John Kennedy. And these two men, with their enormous power and influence, had begun to set out some ground rules for peace and for an attempt at relaxation of the tension between the two powerful systems. The Test Ban Treaty was one example. The hotline between the White House and the Kremlin was another. The Russians recently puzzled the world when they arrested a distinguished American scholar for so-called espionage, but they returned to the fundamental agreement when President Kennedy personally intervened. The scholar was released because John Fitzgerald Kennedy put on the heat. Now, one of the two men accustomed to this high-level dialogue is gone, and means will have to be found to get it started again. That will take time. While it is going on, there will be further attempts to widen the commercial and cultural contacts with the countries behind the Iron Curtain. And these attempts will be led by America's allies in Europe, by the West Germans, by the British. The personality of John F. Kennedy had in the past been able to exert some American influence and control on these widening contacts between the West and the countries of Eastern Europe, contacts which bring both promise and danger to the West. In this field, the new American president will have his hands full. Wheat to Russia, most favored nation status to Yugoslavia and Poland, credits for expanded trade. They are all complicated, they are all critical to America's role in the new Europe. President Johnson faces a hard task in determining the course of American policy in these churning European waters. John Chancellor, NBC News, Berlin.
The Johnson administration and the unpredictable Charles de Gaulle is reported from Paris.
The president is dead and a new president is in office, and already throughout Europe and particularly in France, a big question is being asked. What does the tragic death of President Kennedy mean for the future? The French understand with their customary clarity that there is no more important individual in the Western world than the man who holds the office of President of the United States. For it is by his decision that the awesome power of the world's richest and most potently armed nation is wielded. Up to the moment of President Kennedy's assassination, President de Gaulle disagreed with many of his basic decisions and policies. President de Gaulle thinks very little of the United Nations as a peacemaking organization. He believes that the North Atlantic Treaty Organization ought to be reorganized to give the United States a smaller role and France a larger role in basic alliance policy. He is developing France's independent nuclear force despite American objections against nuclear proliferation. He does not believe in discussions with the Russians until they demonstrate that they are ready to make concessions. He has barred Great Britain from the common market. He has his own conception of European unification on the basis of national states and the Franco-German Treaty of Friendship. He is intent on eliminating American influence in Europe. In fact, President de Gaulle has been challenging American leadership on this continent and has considerable reserves about the basic view of the late President of the United States on Atlantic partnership. All this makes quite a list of disagreements, and the list is by no means complete. Nonetheless, there is another side, a basic side, to French policy. It consists in complete loyalty to the Western Alliance as the essential framework of defense against the threat of communist aggression. In short, the agreement between France and the United States can be described as more basic than the disagreements, which are within the pattern of the alliance and aimed at attaining a greater voice within it for France. But the alliance itself has never been called into question, and as the Cuban crisis last year demonstrated, the United States has no ally more loyal than President de Gaulle. None of these French policies are likely to change as a result of President Kennedy's death. But in the highest French circles, there is some concern about what will happen to American policy. For President de Gaulle had a deep regard for President Kennedy. French ministers who have de Gaulle's ear have often told me that they, the French, if they had been American, would have handled matters exactly as President Kennedy handled them. There is no higher praise from one poker player to another. But President Lyndon Johnson, for the French, is an unknown quantity. He has already announced that he will follow the same foreign policy as that of President Kennedy. But there is always a style, a personal note to the way policy is pursued. And the French wonder whether President Johnson will have the size, the dynamism, the knowledge, the judgment, and the decisiveness that is required by a post of such awesome magnitude. I put this question to one of France's highest officials yesterday afternoon, and his reply was, "It is impossible to predict, Only the future will tell. This is Bernard Frizzell, NBC News, Paris.
Latin American reaction, where the Alliance for Progress has not been an unbounded success.
Argentina remains completely stunned by the assassination of President Kennedy, and for the moment at least, all differences between the two countries have dissolved, with Argentina joining the rest of the world in mourning. What will follow remains a question mark, but at this moment, there is no doubt of the sincere, deeply felt grief that the Argentines share with the United States over the loss. However, the questions most asked of all Americans living in Buenos Aires today is, who is this new president, and what is he like? In truth, Argentina, perhaps the best-informed nation of South America, knows almost nothing about President Johnson. And with the new government of Argentina just 6 weeks old, they've had all too little time to prepare themselves for the fantastic events that have followed. This was clearly visible in the abrupt halt to just about everything in Argentina until the government can come up with an estimation of what lies on the road ahead. Argentina and the United States currently are engaged in a serious dispute over the nationalization of the Argentine oil industry and the annulment of oil contracts with United States firms. Late Friday night, Foreign Minister Zavala Ortiz was to have delivered a major foreign policy address to the people of Argentina, presumably concerning Argentine-U.S. relations. The speech was postponed immediately upon receiving the news of President Kennedy's death, and it probably never will be delivered. Argentine Vice President Carlos Peretti and Foreign Minister Zavala Ortiz are in Washington today, not only for the funeral, but to try to get some feeling as to which way the United States winds now will blow under President Johnson. For the moment, the net effect on Argentine politics of the still unbelievable succession of events is that Argentina stands unified in bewilderment. The politicians and the government of President Illia seem to have forgotten all of their differences and are moving as a solid, unified bloc. The cabinet of Dr. Illia, which had not met even once since its appointment because of a wide range of differences, went into a solemn session which was described as singularly harmonious. But obviously, the government and the people of Argentina are waiting to know only one thing. How much friendship can they expect from President Johnson? What they have to work with now simply are past speeches by Mr. Johnson, with words such as those he issued on the second anniversary of the Alliance for Progress when he said, in the long run, what has been started during these 2 years will have greater significance for the life of all of those who are called Americans than anything that has occurred in preceding centuries. Together, we will reach success. This is Ed Arno, NBC News, Buenos Aires.
Italy, troubled with its own political problems, takes a look at the White House.
The change in the American government through assassination coincides with a change in the Italian government through more conventional means. As in the case of Great Britain and West Germany, Italy, also a major member of the NATO alliance, is experiencing a change in leadership. There is anxiety in Italy during this period when its reins of government are changing hands. That anxiety is multiplied because Italy's main partner, the United States, suddenly has a new leader, too. Instead of one unknown, a new Italian government, there are now two unknowns, a new Italian government and a new American president. Lyndon B. Johnson should not be completely unknown to the Italian public. He has visited Italy, but President Johnson is unknown. His visit to Rome in September of last year was brief. Mr. Johnson had a private 40-minute audience with the late Pope John, and he signed an agreement with Foreign Minister Attilio Piccioni to cooperate in minor space research. But few Italians turned out to see Mr. Johnson. The newspapers paid little attention to the visit. Italians are notoriously indifferent to visiting dignitaries. Even the Italian leaders with whom Mr. Johnson met considered his visit more ceremonial than anything else and did not take the trouble to probe his political philosophies. Thus, Lyndon Johnson's accession to the presidency finds an element of apprehension among Italians. Italians knew John Kennedy. They admired him, respected him, were in a measure influenced by him. They present to President Johnson in their newspaper editorials and comments by political leaders an attitude of wishing him well, but of knowing him not at all well. The unknown is always unsettling. The new Italian leader with whom the new American president will probably have to deal is Aldo Moro, 47, a studious law professor, a longtime politician, a man of unusual patience and low-pitched emotions for an Italian. Like Mr. Johnson, Aldo Moro suffered a heart attack several years ago, recovered, and has continued his active political life. Moro is leader of the Catholic Christian Democratic Party and is on the verge of forming a coalition cabinet with three other parties. He is expected to form his cabinet in the next few days, but even that is not sure. Moro plans to include in his cabinet members of the Socialist Party. This is a bold experiment. The Socialists are Marxists and longtime collaborators with the Communists. The purpose of this strange marriage of Catholics and Marxists is to accomplish a long-needed legislative program of economic and social reforms, which more conservative Italian governments have neglected. The price for socialist support, however, may be a loosening in Italy's ties to NATO. The socialists are basically neutralists. They are willing to have Italy remain in NATO, but they want her participation to be passive. The socialists oppose President Kennedy's plan for a NATO nuclear army. The old adage of a chain being as strong as its weakest link applies to the Western Alliance. The old problem of a recalcitrant France confronts President Johnson as it did President Kennedy. But for President Johnson, there may now be the new problem of a reluctant Italy. Irving R. Levine, NBC News, Rome.
More comment now from Latin America.
President Goulart's office announced today that the Brazilian government believes there will be no changes in relations between Brazil and the United States with President Johnson. However, the same announcement said President Goulart will spend today with his close advisors studying the hemispheric implications of the death of President Kennedy. That announcement sums up what Latin America expects now that Mr. Johnson is the new U.S. president. They hope the policies of President Kennedy will continue, but they fear they will not. Latin Americans had great admiration for and placed great trust in President Kennedy. President Kennedy initiated the Alliance for Progress. Latin Americans believed this signaled a new economic era. President Kennedy personally visited four Latin American nations. Nearly every Latin American head of state visited President Kennedy. Latin Americans heralded these visits as evidence that personal relations with the White House were the best ever. Latin Americans place great reliance on personal relationships. Their greatest compliment is that a man is simpatico, sympathetic, congenial, admirable. President Kennedy was all these. Latin American politicians tend to distrust someone they do not know. Latin Americans do not know President Johnson. Editorials hint that Mr. Johnson is a right-wing reactionary. These same editorials imply that Mr. Johnson will not continue fighting for civil rights. These same editorials imply that the interest in Latin America will diminish now that Mr. Johnson is president. These interpretations are either unfair, inaccurate, or far too premature to have any validity. So most Latin American governments will wait a month or so to see what Mr. Johnson says and does about Latin American problems, about the Alliance for Progress, about canceled U.S. oil contracts, about the Panama Canal, or military takeovers. If President Johnson follows President Kennedy's policies, there may be misunderstandings, as there were before. However, at least Latin Americans will know where they stand. Officially, Latin American governments say they expect no changes in relations with the United States. Unofficially, Latin American nations are worried that without President Kennedy, dialogues between North America and Central and South America will be less sympathetic and less cordial. Wilson Hall, NBC News, Rio de Janeiro.
The government of Ludwig Erhard and its response.
West Germany's new chancellor, Ludwig Erhard, is looking forward to close relations with the new president of the United States. Erhard is 66, Johnson 55. Although vastly different in temperament and background, both men are disinclined to experimentation in domestic or foreign policy. Neither, however, could be called a die-hard conservative. These considerations, among others, lead officials here in Bonn to take an optimistic view of relations between the Erhard and Johnson administrations in the year ahead. President Kennedy gained immense popularity here during his June visit, but former Chancellor Konrad Adenauer and some members of his Christian Democratic Party had misgivings about the youthful president's strategy of peace. They feared he might sacrifice German interests or at least perpetuate the division of Germany in his quest for understanding with the Russians. There's no evidence that Erhard ever shared these doubts, although he is known to have shared the widely expressed feeling here that the Kennedy administration had not adequately consulted Bonn before concluding the partial nuclear test ban treaty with Russia. West Germany belatedly signed the agreement after complaining that communist East Germany should not have been allowed to adhere. Erhard was due to have conferred with President Kennedy in Washington tomorrow and Tuesday. As it turns out, he'll see President Johnson at tomorrow's funeral services and hopes to have a chance for political talks before flying back to Bonn, probably Tuesday. The West Germans are eager to learn the new chief executive's intentions about continuing exploratory talks begun by his predecessor with Moscow. Erhard also wants to know whether Mr. Johnson intends to press the proposal for a mixed-manned Allied nuclear fleet. The Germans have agreed to take part in such a force and to pay a share of its $4 billion cost. Officials here who've seen Mr. Johnson in action in Washington and on two visits to Germany while he was vice president have considerable respect for his political savvy, especially his ability to handle Congress. They think this may mean better relations between Congress and the White House, even in an election year. In general, the feeling here is that the new president will carry on his predecessor's policy of close Atlantic partnership and maintenance of powerful American forces in Europe. This is welcome. It will be less welcome if President Johnson should press Bonn to fulfill completely its NATO force goal of 12 divisions. West Germany now has 11 divisions with a 12th in formation, but these forces lack artillery, signal, engineer, and other backup units required to make an effective army. Balanced forces mean an unbalanced budget, something that Erhard has sworn never to allow. Whatever disagreements Erhard and the new president may have in future, they're likely to try to play them down. Both leaders are feeling their way, and both are pledged to preserve the German-American alliance. Wells Hagen, NBC News, Bonn.
The Western Alliance for many is symbolized by the longtime allegiance between the U.S. and England. Here is NBC's senior European correspondent, Joseph C. Harsh.
On the morning after John Kennedy died, the great tolling bell of Westminster Abbey spoke once each minute for an hour. The last previous time it tolled was when King George VI died. It had never before tolled for any American, president or otherwise. The throbbing hurt of that great bell registered a fact which had not until John Kennedy died been fully appreciated here. The fact that for the first time in history, our American president had become accepted and recognized as the true and lawful leader of the Western world. In the London Sunday Telegraph this morning, Peregrine Wurstorn perceptibly noted that if President Kennedy had lived out his expectable 8 years as president, men would be speaking of the Kennedy era, as 100 years ago they spoke of the Victorian era. He had become as much the dominant figure of these times as Queen Victoria was the dominant figure of hers. One could almost translate this into antique political definitions and say that he had in truth, if not in title, become the Emperor of the West. He was not controversial here in Europe. He is undoubtedly mourned more universally here than at home. For here he had no political enemies. He was accepted, trusted, and respected as much among the ranks of labor as among Tories. He was seen only in his role as world statesman, and in that role he had come to be regarded as decisively successful. He's given the credit for pushing back communism and saving the peace at the same time. He brought the world into balance. The British particularly have felt safe and secure during the year between the Cuban crisis and the death of John Kennedy. It will be a year towards which many a nostalgic backward glance will be cast. For here men cannot and do not yet look ahead with confidence. Perhaps the sense of pervasive doubt will swiftly be dispelled by President Johnson. But right now, in the shock of the loss of the known leader who had proven himself, people can only be anxious when the new leader in Washington is, to people here, the unknown president. Literally, no one here really knows Lyndon Johnson or much about him. He was a vague figure in the Washington background who spoke with an accent familiar here only in television westerns and on the vaudeville stage. That a man can speak with a Texas drawl and also be a world statesman is a possibility not before contemplated here. Perhaps it can happen. It never has yet. The fact that the trusted leader could in these modern times be assassinated in the United States is coupled with the unknown quality of his successor and sudden doubt about the outcome of next year's American election. The combination must inevitably, as it does, complicate the management of the alliance and affect the shape and direction of its growth. Certainly the British and French will be more reluctant than ever to leave alliance strategy and nuclear weapons entirely to the United States. The trend must be towards nationalism and independent lines of action. Confidence in a nation which can assassinate a great world figure is shaken, and it cannot be immediately restored. Already this morning, the former Sir Anthony Eaton, now Lord Avon, was saying that the death of President Kennedy will result in greater responsibilities for Britain. Behind that statement lies the thought that it must be some time, if ever, before the peace of the world can again be as solidly founded as it has come to be of recent times on the respect of Nikita Khrushchev for John Kennedy. One reason the peace was founded on John Kennedy was because he was expected to be reelected. Allies and enemies all thought ahead in terms of continuity of American policy for another 5 years. Now they have no assurance of continuity. The president could be Lyndon Johnson for a year and then some other person even less widely known. The possibility of three different American presidents in 3 years of time makes us begin to appear in foreign eyes to be as politically unstable as France did before de Gaulle. One danger is that the Russians will attempt to take advantage of the new uncertainty. If their behavior follows the normal patterns, they will test with a new president with threat and perhaps with a new probing adventure. Another danger frequently mentioned here today was that America will get a rush of blood to the head and itself do something rash and unnecessarily dangerous. President Johnson now has the difficult and perhaps impossible task of winning for himself the confidence which our allies had placed in his predecessor. It took President Kennedy 2 years to win that confidence. It is asking a lot to expect it to be given in shorter time to another man. But to try to end this on a hopeful note, it is also possible that the Allies will now be ready to shoulder a larger share of the burden of defending the West. Joseph C. Harsh, NBC News, London.
November 22nd, 1963. Shortly after noon, two shots ring out from an assassin's rifle, and the course of world history is changed. A young man dies, and all the world pays a reverent tribute. A president leaves the White House in a flag-draped coffin, and people everywhere share the grief of his wife and family. The simple statistics will list him as John Fitzgerald Kennedy, 1917 to 1963, the 35th President of the United States. But the statistics can never tell the story of love and admiration felt by the factory worker in Chicago, the housewife in Los Angeles, the man in the street in Boston or Tallahassee or Wichita. The act of assassination is foul enough. But for it to claim a young and attractive man, a person of dedication, a president who in 2 years and 10 months did so much, this indeed is the highest price.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
This is Russ Ward, NBC News, New York.
Following a 10-second pause for station identification, the NBC Radio Network will continue its coverage as Morgan Beatty and the NBC News staff summarize this second unbelievable day following the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Immediately following this news program, NBC will present a short interlude, Alexander Scourby and the musical work, The Testament of Freedom. We pause now 10 seconds for station identification.
WNBC AM and FM, New York.
Now for NBC News, here is Morgan Beatty.
The time by human clocks at this moment, 11:21 p.m., close to the total waning of the second day. The time by the calendar at this moment is November the 24th, 1963, almost 50 and a half hours after the assassination of the President of the United States in the county of Dallas, state of Texas. The time is less than 24 hours after the suspected killer was just as wantonly wounded fatally in the basement of the Dallas City Jail, before the listening ears and watching eyes of a whole nation, a whole world. The time has come once again to summarize this terrible and untidy span of time and the action that has taken place within its terrible sequences. As we broadcast to you now, the 80,000th plain citizen stands in a line 26 blocks long and several abreast in our nation's capital. Number 80,000 will soon pass in the double line before the catafalque where lies the body of John F. Kennedy. It was placed there just after noon today, where Lincoln and more than a dozen other selected American citizens have lain in state in notice of their service to the nations. On the minds and in the torn hearts of the mourners, who symbolize all of us, are the names of two men almost nobody ever heard of before 1 o'clock Eastern Standard Time on Friday. These two men, Lee Harvey Oswald, the loner, the American citizen who had not confessed, but who had been charged with the murder of the president and the wounding of John Connally, the governor of Texas. And that other equally bizarre character, who, like Oswald, thrust himself unwanted into the history books of the world, Jack Ruby, a scrappy human cur, a product of the streets of the city of Chicago, now a resident of Dallas. He has admitted he took the law into his own hands. He dashed past police guards before noon today, thrust a snub-nosed .38 revolver into the soft stomach of Lee Oswald, who was being transferred from city jail to county jail, and fired. The bullet ended Oswald's life less than 2 hours later. Ruby told his sister in jail tonight, "I had to do it. Don't worry about me." In Washington, the security officialdom of the nation looked with shocked misgivings on the whole incredible tale from the Southwest. They heard with dismay the statement of District Attorney Henry Wade in Dallas County that he would not release the piece of evidence in hand. They were relieved shortly after when he agreed to release all of the evidence concerning Lee Oswald, the evidence concerning the end of the president's life. Federal authorities are positively committed, as is the mayor of Dallas, Earl Cabell. This record must be and is now being given to posterity. Back in Washington, a diplomatic mystery. What goes through the minds of the visiting dignitaries from around the world at this close to midnight hour? We cannot know. Our State Department had assured all nations that ambassadors may well represent any nation at the president's final funeral passage to Arlington Cemetery tomorrow. Nevertheless, 84 nations so far have deemed it important and meet, even including our primary rival in the world, Russia, to send the highest officials they can spare to Washington as a special mark of respect. Tomorrow they will take part in majestic passage from the rotunda of the Capitol to the White House and to St. Matthew's Cathedral for final requiem mass. Some will join the cortege at the White House with Mrs. Kennedy and walk the final 5 blocks to hear an appeal to a higher-than-human power for mercy on all men and their souls. That, in summary, is the series of events that will be written into history, a most unclassic sequence of tragedy, including all but its final and public act tomorrow. And now the summary in detail. First, to Bryson Rash, NBC News, in the rotunda of the Capitol of the United States.
The day here started at just before 2 p.m. But an hour before that, at 1 p.m., the president's body was placed on a caisson and taken, brought here to Capitol Hill. It was then lifted up the great white steps and placed at rest in the exact center of the rotunda, the head pointed directly west, the feet pointed to the east. And then, in very brief and moving ceremonies, there were three eulogies spoken. One by the Majority Leader of the Senate, Senator Mike Mansfield, by the Chief Justice of the United States, Earl Warren, and by the Speaker of the House of Representatives, John McCormick. A president's wreath was then placed in position at the foot of the casket in which lies the body of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Mrs. Kennedy had brought both of her children into the rotunda with her. Young John Jr. left within a very few moments. Caroline stayed on. Then Mrs. Kennedy, with Caroline at her side, went to the catafalque, kneeled for just a moment in prayer, and kissed the flag-draped casket, and then returned to her position. There were more than 1,000 of the highest dignitaries of the United States government gathered here to pay their respects and to honor the late president. The diplomatic corps was represented by its dean, Ambassador Sevilla Sacasa of Nicaragua. And then the dignitaries left and the public took over. They took over at about 3 o'clock, and they had been pouring through the rotunda ever since that moment. It is estimated that perhaps as many as 75,000 have come through here up to this time, from 3 o'clock until 11 o'clock. That figure may be high, but it is an estimate. It is also estimated that there are still remaining to come into the rotunda more than 200,000 people. The line extends for approximately 32 blocks in Washington, 16 blocks in one direction, and then it doubles back on itself for an additional 16 blocks. And they continue to pour through here. In order to expedite their passage through the rotunda, the line has been doubled so that they go by 2 abreast. The ropes have been moved very close to the casket now, perhaps 10 feet or less, and they go by quite rapidly. And in the midst as this line goes through, the people have been standing in line for up to 7 hours to view this scene of their late president. And in the midst of this, from time to time, have come visits by distinguished people. The ambassadors have come. The president of Ireland, Mr. Eamon de Valero, visited just a short while ago. The president's family has been here frequently. Mrs. Rose Kennedy, the president's mother. Mrs. Eunice Shriver, the wife of the director of the Peace Corps. Mrs. Ethel Kennedy, the wife of the Attorney General. And Mrs. Joan Kennedy, the wife of the senator from Massachusetts. They have visited here to be with their brother for just a moment in peace. But perhaps the most dramatic of all the visitations here tonight was a return by Mrs. Jacqueline Kennedy. She arrived in the rotunda shortly after 9 o'clock. She was accompanied by her brother-in-law, the brother of the president, Attorney General Robert Kennedy. They went inside the enclosure, roped off by velvet ropes, and Mrs. Kennedy went to the casket alone for just a moment, kneeled, or rather genuflected, touched the casket, and left. At the present moment, astronaut John Glenn, Jr., and his wife have appeared here on the rotunda with their 2 children to pay their respects to the late President Kennedy. I beg your pardon. It is John Glenn and Mrs. Glenn. Their children are not with them. The astronaut files by slowly with Mrs. Glenn. They look at the casket. And now they turn and leave the rotunda. To continue the day, Mrs. Kennedy came shortly after 9 o'clock. Unannounced, she genuflected beside the casket and then left with the Attorney General. She spoke to people as she left and then went down the broad stairway to a waiting limousine. But Mrs. Kennedy said that she would prefer to walk. So the 2 of them, the Attorney General and the widow of the President of the United States, set off arm in arm across the darkened East Plaza. They walked across a grassy plot. There were no people nearby. Accompanying them were a handful of Capitol Police, perhaps four, and one Secret Service man. Maybe five reporters following that small group. We reporters were asked not to interfere with her solitude or with her peace. We did not, of course. Then Mrs. Kennedy walked across the plaza past the Senate wing of the Capitol and plunged through a crowd that had was milling on the sidewalk. She was not recognized. Mrs. Kennedy was wearing a black coat, and her hair was down in a black scarf. Her face did not have a veil. She then walked down Capitol Hill through the twisting driveways between parked automobiles on the grass. People coming up Capitol Hill did not recognize her. She got to the corner of First and Constitution Avenue, accepted the condolence offered by someone. By this time, she had been recognized by just a handful of people, perhaps 10 or so, and they dropped into line behind the reporters. Then Mrs. Kennedy and the Attorney General walked south on First Street. That block from the Capitol building to First Street is a great, long, generous block. And she turned first, then she turned south on First Street. She stopped to speak to a group of nuns. They offered their sympathy. She thanked them. She walked on down First Street. And the Attorney General spoke to her quietly. She nodded her head. The Secret Service asked police for assistance, and traffic was stopped. Her limousine had followed her down the hill. It was in the middle of the street when it was stopped, and Mrs. Kennedy and the Attorney General drove their way out to the automobile, got in, drove off, presumably back to the White House. The absolutely most intriguing part of this is the fact that Mrs. Kennedy was not recognized. Those who did recognize her respected her completely and left her alone to be with the Attorney General in this moment of great sorrow. The schedule for the day begins at 10 a.m. when the doors here at the Rotunda are closed, and it is quite likely there will still be people waiting to get in to view the catafalque and the casket containing the body of the president. The late president's body will be taken from the Rotunda at 11 a.m. and on a cortege. It will be placed on a caisson, and in a cortege will be taken to the White House. There, other dignitaries will join the group. From the White House, it will go to St. Matthew's Cathedral in Washington. Mrs. Kennedy and heads of state and other dignitaries plan to walk that five blocks from the White House to St. Matthew's for this farewell mass. The mass should be over shortly after 1 p.m. After mass, the funeral cortege goes to Arlington Cemetery and symbolically past the Lincoln Memorial. It will arrive at Arlington at approximately 2:15, and the burial will occur shortly thereafter. Mrs. Kennedy will then return to the White House, where she will receive the heads of government and the other foreign dignitaries who will fly here to Washington for this final day. At 7 p.m., President Lyndon Baines Johnson will receive the heads of state at the State Department in Washington. This is Bryson Rash, NBC News, reporting from the Rotunda in Washington.
A report from where the plain people of our nation, symbolized by the plain people of the city of Washington, D.C., and surrounding territories in Maryland and Virginia, are paying their respects to the late President Kennedy. The dignitaries on this day had their place in a historic moment, and they were those people who came here to pay respects, as we have said, from 84 nations, and maybe more will be represented by dignitaries by tomorrow. Of course, the chief of all of them, by protocol, is President Charles de Gaulle of France. He is chief by protocol for the simple reason that he is the only chief of state and head of government so far to arrive here. The President of the United States is chief of state and head of government. France and the Fifth Republic is the only nation in the world that has a major nation that has a chief of state who is also head of the government and by protocol is equal to the President of the United States. President Charles de Gaulle arrived late today. He was greeted by Secretary of State Dean Rusk, At International Airport, that's one of the four airports that are receiving dignitaries, and taken immediately to the French embassy. He has stated before that he felt it absolutely necessary that he be here in his own personal presence to represent the people of France. And as he walked through the airport after shaking hands with those necessary to greet him, he spoke to his associates, "Allons, allons," he said, three or four times. "Let's go." And they went to the French embassy. Also on hand already are Prime Minister Ikeda of Japan and Eamon de Valera of Ireland, the president of a nation who is in his 81st or 82nd year. He's almost totally blind. And then came West German Chancellor Erhard, accompanied by his foreign and defense ministers. And there's Britain's Prince Philip, who represents Queen Elizabeth of England, who cannot come because she is near the time of a child, a third child. And there's Russia's first deputy premier, Anastas Mikoyan, representing Premier Khrushchev. Well, he will arrive early tomorrow morning. Premier Khrushchev has insisted that Russia should be represented. He did this as a mark of respect not only to the American people, he said, but because President Kennedy is a realist for peace, and he admired this man. Incidentally, Prince Philip was not only greeted by our Secretary of State, Dean Rusk, but as a measure of respect, all of the ambassadors of the Commonwealth Nations of Britain were on hand to greet him when he arrived. And, of course, there was an extremely busy day in Washington for the President of the United States, Lyndon Baines Johnson. President Johnson is conducting his business from his home in Spring Valley, a home he acquired from Pearl Mesta, a Washington hostess, 2 years ago. The Secret Service are there, the only mark that it differs from any other home in this rather plush area near Washington. The president conducted business all day because he felt that some things had to go on, some things of great importance. Perhaps he even thought that we should know that the business of the government, our continuing government, was being handled. The first official act of the president in his first full day in the office of chief executive was to reaffirm the policy objectives of John Kennedy in South Vietnam, where there's trouble with the Viet Cong communists. President Johnson received Henry Cabot Lodge, Jr., the ambassador to Vietnam, who had previously been summoned to Washington by President Kennedy. A rather quaint note here in protocol and deference. Ambassador Lodge had stopped in San Francisco, and he was resting there before having his appointment on this Sunday with President Kennedy, when he heard of the death of his chief executive. Ambassador Lodge immediately announced that he would proceed to Washington to report to the Secretary of State, that it would be presumptive on his part, presumptuous, to make a report to a president who had not asked for one. Today, President Johnson, despite all of the pressing duties around him, asked for that report to stress the continuity of our policies in Southeast Asia. And the White House disclosed that every policy heretofore followed in South Vietnam will be continued. There was a full-scale review of the new government and its fight against the Viet Cong in Vietnam. There was also a decision that our forces in that part of the world will be withdrawn as soon as possible, and the schedule for withdrawal already set by President Kennedy will be carried forward under President Johnson. And the announcement was made by Pierre Salinger, President Kennedy's news secretary. And he noted that the president would leave up to the intelligence of the officials involved how long they wished to serve him there. Incidentally, it's already been noted that President Johnson asked all ambassadors and all cabinet officers to continue to serve. Dignitaries, business in Washington. Incidentally, permission was given today for the national banks to close. It is assumed that savings and loan institutions will close, along with state banks all over the world, for the final requiem mass for John Fitzgerald Kennedy tomorrow. Inevitably, at this point, we must go by contrast It draws us like a magnet. The scene in Dallas of the second tragedy. It was about 10 o'clock today, apparently, that this scene began to unfold. The part of it that we tell you now was not known to the public or to anyone when it began. It was a moment when a nightclub operator in Dallas, Texas, got into his automobile and drove from that club 4 blocks to the Dallas City Jail. In the jail was, of course, Lee Oswald, the suspected killer of President Kennedy. Jack Ruby, the nightclub operator, parked his automobile across the street from the basement of the jail and walked rather hastily across the street. And then he leaped over a 3-foot barrier and dashed, before anybody could do anything about it, dashed into the basement of the jail. Inside, reporters, policemen, guards were waiting for the transfer of Lee Oswald from the jail to an armored car to be taken for safekeeping into the county jail of Dallas County. No one could have known what would happen next, but it so happened that the world saw it. The whole world saw what happened next, the murder of Lee Oswald. Here is that scene.
There's the prisoner.
Yeah,
there is Lee Oswald.
He's been shot. He's been shot. Lee Oswald has been shot. There's the man with a gun. It's absolute panic. Absolute panic here in the basement of Dallas Police Headquarters. Detectives have their guns drawn. Oswald has been shot. There is no question about it. Oswald has been shot. Pandemonium has broken loose here in the basement of Dallas Police Headquarters. Now, whether the bullet literally hit Oswald or not, we are not absolutely positive. But there has been a gunshot. Oswald reached for his stomach, doubled up. It'll be impossible to determine whether he was hit or not. Did you see whether or not he was hit? He was hit, wasn't he?
He grabbed himself on the side and fell to the ground.
That was my understanding. We were, what, 4 feet away from him?
I was 5 feet in front of him when he shot.
What is your name?
Frank Johnson.
And you're with
UPI.
He did grab his stomach. I saw him grab his stomach.
Right from the side.
And there you have heard the greatest piece of television and radio journalism since the beginning of this medium, nearly 30 years ago. The reporter, Tom Pettit of NBC News, who alone reported exactly and all of what happened there. But naturally, at the moment this shooting occurred, Tom Pettit could not organize his thoughts. You have absorbed what he absorbed as fast as he absorbed it. Since then, of course, he's had time to organize his thoughts, and as tired as he is, we've asked him to do it and to tell us, in an organized way, what happened this morning just after 11 o'clock. To Tom Pettit, NBC News in Dallas.
Here's what had happened in the basement of the Dallas Police Department. Just as Oswald was about to walk the 20 yards or so to an armored car, which was to carry him to the Dallas County Jail, a man identified almost immediately as Jack Ruby walked out of a group of reporters, quickly across the roadway, up to Oswald, and fired at point-blank range into his lower abdomen. Just before that moment, a police officer had shouted, we are told now, Jack USOB. As Oswald, mortally wounded, was retrieved inside the building to await an ambulance, another officer subdued Ruby, and he was immediately put into jail. One officer, handcuffed to Oswald, we are told now, tried to jerk him out of the way of the .38 snub-nosed revolver, but did not succeed. Oswald died at the hospital. Ruby is held in jail. Tonight, District Attorney Wade said he had seen Ruby at the police station Friday night as Oswald was taken down a corridor the night after President Kennedy's assassination. Tom Pettit, NBC News in Fort Worth, Dallas.
Lee Oswald was taken with a wound just below the rib cage, a dark and purple wound that did not bleed. He was taken to Parkland Memorial Hospital, exactly the same hospital where President Kennedy was taken the day before, and he was wheeled to the opposite side of the corridor, about 10 or 15 feet from where President Kennedy had laid the day before. And there, 12 physicians in relays worked over him, but they discovered exactly what they had discovered in the case of President Kennedy. There was no hope of saving his life. In his case, it was different in that President Kennedy had been shot in the brain and in the neck, and massive damage had been done to brain tissue, the kind of brain tissue that motivates respiration and heart. And, of course, there was no way to save him. He died in 20 minutes. But today, Lee Oswald lasted nearly 2 hours. But there was massive damage to his liver, to one of his kidneys, to many blood vessels in his abdomen, and the doctors knew from the moment they began an operation that there was no hope for his life. All day long in Dallas, the police continued to insist that they had plenty of evidence that Lee Harvey Oswald had been the killer of the President of the United States. There were definite bits of evidence that traced the rifle he had bought, a rifle manufactured in Italy, a 6.5 Italian carbine. That had been traced from Italy to a mail-order house in the United States, from the mail-order house to the post office lockbox maintained by Oswald in Dallas. It had been traced to his home, and yet there were slight gaps. The police said that they had closed the case, and District Attorney Henry Wade earlier today had announced in Dallas that the case was now moot against Oswald, meaning that, in a sense, it had been finished. There was no point in carrying it any further, and he would not reveal, he said earlier today, all of the testimony he had and evidence he had. He did say, the district attorney did say, that the evidence was conclusive. In Washington, immediately, there was shocked surprise that anything like that would happen, that any such evidence would be concealed publicly. And so later, in Dallas, the district attorney of Dallas County changed his mind. I think he has begun to recognize that he is inevitably a part of a tremendous historical fact, however distasteful that fact may be. And he acted quickly tonight to change his idea of the record of this story and what shall be done with it. And for that story, we take you to Robin McNeil in Dallas.
Dallas police, who refused today to say anything more about the evidence against Lee Oswald, tonight changed their tune. Stung by reports that the Justice Department was dissatisfied with the investigation, Dallas District Attorney Henry Wade called a press conference and went through the evidence piece by piece. What he said was in every detail what has been published, except for one main fact. Wade said Oswald bought the murder rifle, took it Friday morning to Dallas, was in the window of the building overlooking the route. The new detail was that Oswald's palm print was on the rifle as well as on a box in the window. Contrary to earlier statements, Wade said the case is not closed, although he personally has no doubt that Oswald killed President Kennedy. Robert McNeil, NBC News, in Fort Worth, Dallas.
The decision to reveal all of the evidence in the case against Lee Oswald has relieved some of the tension in Washington. Our high officials there have been worried about the reaction in other nations, among other governments, as to the tragic and violent events in the United States in the last few days. Other nations have a tendency to think of us as a rather reckless nation, even though many of them have shown instabilities far greater than ours. But nevertheless, we are the leading world power today, and anything that happens here causes reverberations, reactions, and in this case, those reactions and reverberations are not at all favorable to the image of the United States, either in the free world or the communist world. Therefore, you can understand when our officials in Washington reacted as they did when the Dallas authorities said at first they were not going to release the evidence against Oswald. They cried out in their private hearts that this not be so, because this is making a mystery, this is creating suspicions. Hence, there was reaction in Washington. And for that reaction, we go now to Sander Van Oker in Washington.
Dallas District Attorney Henry Wade said today he would not divulge any more of the evidence local officers have against Oswald. Said Wade, the Oswald case is moot now, and we have to get on with the Ruby case. The Justice Department says the Oswald case, so far as the federal government is concerned, is not closed. Katzenbach told me tonight the Justice Department will continue its investigation of Oswald and the events surrounding the president's death. Officials concede the evidence is very strong that Oswald was the president's assassin, and the evidence, they'll add privately, comes pretty much from the FBI. But there's no disposition here tonight to let the Dallas police or the Dallas District Attorney say without challenge that the Oswald case is closed because he is dead. They tell you with some bitterness it is not up to local officials to say this is the end to the investigation of the murder of a president. An attempt will be made to gain federal jurisdiction of the Oswald case, and there are many ways to do it. The purpose of this is so that when all the leads have been run down, and this may take a long time, then the evidence in the Oswald case can be made public. Though it is not a federal crime to kill a president, the Justice Department takes the attitude it has the duty to fully investigate the case and make its findings public. These are the facts as a reporter must report them. But a reporter must also report an attitude and a state of mind. And tonight it must be said that some officials in this government find the events too complicated in Dallas and too puzzling to leave any longer to the competence of Dallas authorities. While they concede that the case against Oswald was a strong one, they also ask, were there others involved? Did he do this of his own volition, or was he put up to it? And they want to know what a nightclub owner with a police record was doing inside the basement while Oswald was being moved. It's true that anyone who knows anything about American cities knows that police are familiar, perhaps too familiar, with nightclub owners. But officials here wonder if that was any reason for allowing Ruby to slip in with reporters. Did they, ask, someone want Oswald killed so he could not talk? They continue to ask these questions as they seek to gain federal jurisdiction of the Oswald case. They have a lot of theories. Some, they will admit, seem far out. But then, as one official said to me tonight, what is more far out than the murder of the President of the United States? This is Sander Van Oker, NBC News, Washington.
It was exactly that reaction in Washington, conveyed to the Dallas authorities, that produced a complete revelation of all the evidence in the hands of the Texas authorities. And now we have it that they will release anything else they get as they get it or soon thereafter, and all of it will be in the hands of the federal authorities of the United States government in time to come. And I can report on my own two facts that have not yet been reported. One is that the federal authorities have not discovered any connection between Lee Oswald and any subversive organization or any other government in the world. They have conveyed this to other governments to be sure that others understand that whatever suspicion attaches to this man attaches in a way that is not direct. But every investigative agency of our government, for some time to come, will investigate, as Mr. Van Oker has told you, every possible lead to be sure that their conclusion at this time is final, that when the history books are written, 2 years from now, 10 years from now, 100 years from now, every possible fact concerning the assassination of President Kennedy will be before the people of the world. This is a free nation, and the concealment of facts of this kind in itself would be ultimately tantamount to crime. Twice on this second day after the assassination, twice, men of keen minds have referred to the violent death of President Kennedy and his accused killer. They've referred to it publicly in a way that seems to speak for all Americans, or at least the thoughts that all Americans should have at this time. In Washington Cathedral, the Episcopal Reverend Francis B. Thayer, Jr., in his sermon today, said, "The weapon that killed John Kennedy was not only in the hand of the murderer, but was in the heart of every one of us who ever hated, who ever set brother against brother in his selfish spirit. Blame not," he said, "the man, nor the city, nor the region where the deed was done. But let us search our own hearts to see if pettiness or hostility set the stage for the overt act that occurred 2 days ago." And today, in the echoing rotunda of the Capitol, Chief Justice Earl Warren said this over the bier of the slain president: "What moved some misguided wretch to do this horrible deed may never be known to us. But we do know that such acts are commonly stimulated by forces of hatred and malevolence, such as today are eating their way into the bloodstream of American life. What a price we pay for this fanaticism." It has been said, he went on, that the only thing we learn from history is that we do not learn. But surely we can learn if we have the will to do so. Does ever a criminal, sane or insane, know how far the rippling damage of his violence reaches? That is a question I put to you. How deep into the lives of millions of people? He does not know. I, a news reporter, put that question to you. Part of the answer to that question comes from NBC's correspondent in far-off Anchorage, Alaska. An Eskimo man stumbled out of the cold of the night. It was 12 degrees below zero. Stumbled into a cafe. He had traveled far. As he warmed himself in the cafe, he kept repeating, "He was a great man. He was a great man. He was a great man. And somebody had to put a slug into him." The Eskimo turned and asked the aproned waiter in the cafe what time Mass would be said. He found out, and the Eskimo explained, "I have stayed awake all night. I have traveled far. I want to go to Mass. He deserves at least that much from me." And when the time came, a few minutes later, he stumbled out to church. Part of the answer. And now, before I give you another part of that answer, I report that this is Morgan Beatty in Radio Central, New York. Perhaps the most spontaneous answer occurred in Fifth Avenue in New York, a few hours after a rifle bullet traveled 75 yards from a warehouse into the brain of President Kennedy on Friday. On that day, it was dusk, in the first traumatic day. People drifted by ones and twos and threes into St. Patrick's Cathedral on Fifth Avenue, until one worshiper, unknown to another, they had formed a congregation of perhaps 2,500 persons. They prayed and sat in silence, one among them without a word, without a sign from any other one, went to the organ in that great church. He began to play, and just about on the second or the third note, every voice in that church came into life spontaneously, came into song.